So welcome again to the Glasgow Buddhist Centre Rainy Season Retreat. Tonight I'm going to be talking about confession. And I felt very keen to be giving a talk on confession initially. But as I was writing... See what I did there? But as I was writing the talk, I thought, oh, blimey. So I asked a few people if they had any really funny stories about their experience of confession. And, you know, nobody had any. So that's not great. Anyway, I'm going to start with training. So practicing the precepts is a training. It's an ongoing process. And it requires a couple of things, not least reflection, time and space for reflection. And it requires sensitivity. And it requires us to adopt a really strong sense of ownership in this practicing of the precepts, since following the precepts, it really isn't formulaic. Can't say that enough. And what I mean by that is that it is really up to us. It's up to each one of you as an individual to identify where the challenge is uniquely for you in each precept. Yeah? What aspect of our behaviour needs to have a kindly light shone on it? Where is the edge? And this is completely different for every single individual. And it also differs for you over time. Yeah? So there may be something in my ethical behaviour that actually I don't find particularly that much of a challenge, because I've just, my past conditioning means that I have got a certain facility, a certain awareness in that area. Whereas for you, it might be a really uphill struggle. It might be a drag. But there's something where you are doing the backstroke and I'm really struggling. Yeah. So we are not cookie cutter people. And we've all got our own unique backstory, life story into this moment. So my practice of the precepts is completely different from that of each one of you here. Yeah? So it really isn't formulaic. We have to find our way in practicing the precepts. So in this, we're training in developing an ethical sensibility. Yeah? Learning where the corners are. Part of this training is being sensitive and responsive to where there is some lack in us. And if it's a lack, it's a lack of awareness. So it can shift. Some habit that means that our sensibility is a bit blunt. And in this training, as well as us having to be the driver for how we practice ethically and, you know what area we're taking more care in, we are also the driver for how we evaluate the progress that we're training, the progress of our training. So we are responsible for seeing where we've made mistakes. Now, of course, the universe will give you feedback, but we're responsible for taking that feedback, yes? And pausing and taking that feedback on board, having a good look at where we have made a mistake, and bringing awareness to that in order to strengthen our overall practice. And this is confession. This is it. In all my actions, may I watch my mind, and as soon as disturbing emotions arise, may I firmly face them all at once, since they will hurt both me and others. So this is a third verse from the 8 verses of mind training. In all my actions, may I watch my mind, and as soon as disturbing emotions arise, may I firmly face them all at once, since they will hurt both me and others. And in an alternative translation, it says, may I firmly face and avert them. Yeah? So averting the disturbing emotions. But the key is to face. Yeah? So this is expressing really clearly, it's expressing a strong commitment to training the mind and being vigilant for any kind of unskillful impulses or actions, since they will hurt both myself and others. So the mind training has a really powerful awareness of the law of karma. Actions have consequences. Actions are live. Nothing is neutral, including non-action. Now, in this talk, I want to focus more on the mind precepts, because the body and the speech precepts are rooted in the mind. So it's not exactly, it's not true to say that the mind precepts are more important. It's more that all unskillful manifestations come from the lack of awareness, which is our basic ignorance or manifestation of craving and aversion. So in the words of the positive mind precepts, abandoning covetousness for tranquility, I purify my mind. Changing hatred into compassion, I purify my mind. Transforming ignorance into wisdom, I purify my mind. Now, one of the things about confession, before we get into the dark corners and the bits with spiders hanging off them, we can all just relax and rely on the fact that we've all got dark corners and we've all got stuff and we've all got content, okay? So there is a certain equality. There's a certain leveling here, yes? If the idea of hearing about confession makes you feel a bit uncomfortable, please let me just say, well, actually, what this involves is just turning towards the fact that we've all got stuff, yeah? We're all a bit shabby. We're all a bit shabby and a bit cracked. So we're just entering that community, yeah, of the shabby and the cracked, yeah? So the practice of the precepts and the practice of confession, it's a movement from small, habitual, automatic mind into big mind, yeah? Big, expansive mind, clear blue sky mind, crystal clear mind. It's Vajra mind, yeah? So this is us entering into a mind of love, yeah? So if I know that I'm a bit shabby and that I'm a bit, you know, the practice of my precepts is a bit sloppy here and there, a mind of love can just turn towards that, yeah? It can just turn towards that. Now, confession isn't a contracted, regretful practice, yeah? It's actually a very positive practice. So it's not about wringing your hands and kind of raking over about how rubbish you are. It really, really isn't about that, yeah? Confession is a very heart-opening practice. It's about opening up to big mind, yeah? It's about opening up to wise conduct. And it's like restoring yourself, yeah? Restoring yourself. Standing on the ground of your true potential. It's about developing confidence and virya more than anything. I think that's what confession helps us do. Abandoning covetousness for tranquility, changing hatred into compassion, and transforming ignorance into wisdom. So confession, as I've said, it's about opening up, and it's about letting go of our limits, seeing them and letting them go. And if necessary, it's about forgiving yourself, yeah? So as I said, it's about developing this kind of sensibility, a sensitive sensibility that's fine, that's clear, that's precise and aware. And it's really different from guilt. So guilt is a sort of interned and turning over, ruminating, sometimes an anxious kind of loathing. Yeah, it's a loathing of what we've done or what we might have done or what we fear to be. So guilt's a real shadow emotion. And confession is really about standing, you know, in a way seeing the shadows, walking towards them and then becoming clear of them. So guilt just holds us in this particularly unclear form of feeling bad. Yeah, feeling bad about ourselves. So what guilt really, really needs is metta. Yeah, more than anything else. Guilt needs metta. It needs compassion and whatever helps us feel more expansive. Because guilt by its very nature is contracting. It's narrowing down. Guilt is not clear. Guilt's very muddy and full of doubt. It's full of confusion, so it's narrowing down, whereas clarity opens us up. So if you are prone to guilt, then self-love. Self-love is always the way. Yeah? And just being sensitive to what brings you joy, what brings about enjoyment in your life. Yeah? Because guilt is life-denying. So just being aware of where the enjoyment is in life and increasing a sense of self-worth through that joy, through that enjoyment. So yeah, confidence and love is what's needed when we fall into this. And I was thinking about the Buddha Amitabha with respect to guilt, and thinking about perhaps how practice around the Buddha Amitabha might be an antidote for guilt. So there's that deep red light. When I was ordained, I took on the Padmasambhava practice, and he has the deep red light that's like the light of the Buddha Amitabha. And how I felt that was like unconditional love. Yeah, unconditional love. And Amitabha, in the Pure Land practice, Amitabha looks at you and he says, come as you are. Come as you are. So it's completely unconditional. And the Buddha Amitabha, he has a contentment, a deep contentment that's completely free from craving, yeah? And he has this wisdom of discriminating awareness. So the Buddha Amitabha, you might be a bit messed up, but the Buddha Amitabha is really, really clear about perhaps what you did unskillfully, but that's it. It's just like a bunch of actions led to consequences. And the Buddha Amitabha knows really, really deeply that you are not thoroughly bad to the bone, yeah? But you made a mistake. So the Buddha Amitabha's got a clarity through his discriminating wisdom. And we can rely on that, yeah? Om Amideva Hri. He just loves you, you know? And I think that sometimes Vajrasattva is often connected with confession because he stands for primordial purity. But sometimes I think the bright light of Vajrasattva is a bit too bright. You know, if you're feeling a bit tender and a bit, not very good about yourself, I think the deep red light of Amitabha might be the way to go. Om Amideva Hri. So yeah, I just think that a precursor, an important precursor to confession is metta. Yeah, we need a really positive base of self-love. So, but what is confession? You know, what does it look like? Not everybody in this room will have a live practice of confession, so it would be good to just go into the details of maybe what it looks like. So, I mean, the first thing is that confession is actually, confession is a simple act, yeah? And in that simplicity, it's good if you can be as explicit as you can when you are making confession. So if you're confessing something, if you have the urge to confess something, what I suggest is don't just slip it into the conversation that you happen to be having, right? Because you need a context for it, yeah? So a context that I've got is my order chapter. But you might have like a going for refuge group, or you might have a mitra group or something where there's a space for it. And if you're not in that kind of context and you've seen something in your ethical conduct and you thought, I could confess that, then what I'd say is say it to a friend in the Sangha and just tell them that you would like to confess something. Yeah, that's what I mean. That's all I mean by making it explicit. Yeah. Just tell that person that you have a confession so that that person knows on what level you're talking. And then be specific about which precept. This is the gold. This is the nugget. Be specific about which precept or precepts you've broken. Yeah? So that is really important. Yeah? But don't lapse into a sort of vague sense that you've just been a bit unskillful, so just kind of talk about how you were a bad person. Yeah, be really specific. If you can see the precept that you've broken, you have a better chance of understanding the underlying mental state and the way in which conditionality was at play. So the other couple of nights ago, Smriti Ratna was talking about the heart of Buddhist ethics, and he was saying it's just really important to know what the underlying mental state was. Yeah. So be specific about the precept, and be specific about the underlying mental state if you can. So as I said earlier, confession involves seeing how the law of karma is at play, yeah, and seeing the inner mental states that gave rise to the conditions. That is so helpful. And then there's like a kind of tendency with confession, right? It's a slightly obscuring, it's a tendency of obscuration, yeah? So that's getting into telling a great big long story about it, yeah? So often with a confession, the longer and more detailed the description is of what has happened, the easier it is to actually end up just blaming it on the external conditions. It all gets a bit farther away from you and you end up letting yourself off the hook. You maybe didn't mean to, but that's kind of the way it goes. So you get into how that person pushed you in the queue, and actually you were really tired and your shoes were too tight, and then the queue got stuck for ages, and then there was a woman in front of you in the queue and she had a baby and the baby was puking and you thought the baby was going to puke in your basket, and then the fire alarm went off, right? And by the time you got back in the queue and you got to the head of the queue, and then you just shouted at the cashier, you know? So it's like it all gets compounded. Now that's what happens in real life, isn't it? Because it's a mess and it does get compounded, but the more details we pour on board, the more it's just like a whole set of extenuating circumstances. So try not to tell a shaggy dog story when you make a confession. Yeah, perhaps at the heart of the confession is that you were tired and so you became impatient and annoyed, and then you were rude to the cashier, or you shouted at them, and that's it. That's it. So the impatience and the annoyance, that's the ninth precept, yeah? And shouting or speaking rudely at the cashier is the fifth precept, yeah? And I think, yeah, so telling a great big long story about it is slightly obscuring. Sometimes I try and get by being entertaining when I'm doing a confession. That's not good either. But in order for this incident in the queue to be an actual confession, there's one thing: you have to regret it. Yeah? So you have to kind of go, it's like the big mind kind of calls to you slightly, and you just kind of feel it. So you have to have a little pang of remorse. Yeah? You have to know that actually you don't want to do that again. So even if the chances are that you might do that again, my two best confessions, my two most common confessions are ill will and some kind of like crabbit speech. But I have to, in order to confess them, I have to know that I don't want to do them again. Yeah. So even though chances are I know that I will, it's good to get to the point where you don't want to. But sometimes we've broken a precept and actually we can see it, but we don't feel remorse, yeah? We don't want to let go of it. And that's just the way it is. We don't want to let go of it, possibly because actually we feel justified. We felt justified then and we feel justified now. So we're still upholding the energy that was at play there and whatever it was. And quite often that, for me, that feeling still feeling justified is around the ninth precept. It's around ill will, hatred, yeah? I still think that person's a baggage. Yeah. So I still feel justified. And actually, if that's the case, that is actually okay, because we're in training here. Yeah. What we can do is, well, we can't actually confess to that ill will or whatever, you know, whatever the active mental state was. But what we can do is acknowledge it real clearly. Yeah. Even in a kind of formal way. And we can make clear that it's not a full confession, but we can acknowledge something. We're saying that this is an acknowledgement and we haven't let go of it yet, and we still feel justified or defensive. In a sense, whatever it is that was in us is still live. But what the acknowledgement does is it brings it, it becomes explicit, and it means that we are owning that reactive driver. So we're owning it, but we're not ready to confess it. That is all still good stuff. That is still training in ethics, yeah? Even if we're holding on and justifying. Yeah, so just acknowledging reactivity is good. Now, there's a really specific reason why I said don't just kind of like pop a confession into a conversation. Just say, oh, look, actually, I would like to confess something. And what I said was then that person knows what level you're talking on. Because what could happen is if you haven't flagged up what it is that you're talking about, that listener don't quite know how to listen clearly to them. So you start telling them the story of how you got stuck in the queue in Boots the Chemist and it was a queue from hell and you ended up shouting at the cashier. And the person you're talking to, they might just go, oh God, yeah, they're really useless in that shop. And that's not what you wanted, you know. And they might say, they might sort of, yeah, they might just kind of go, oh God, that was just like a really rotten time for you, wasn't it? And in a way, that's not what you're asking for. You don't really want them to let you off the hook. Yeah, you want them to recognise that you're saying that you did something that you don't want to do again. Yeah, that's it. I did something. It's a bad habit. Or it was just a waste of my energy. And I just want to leave it behind. I just want a clean slate. So see it, let it be heard. Put it down, yeah? And hopefully it can have a cleanness to it in that, yeah? If you're saying it clearly and it's being heard and understood that you want to put it down, then that can hopefully have a clean character to it. And if it doesn't, if it's got a bit of weight and it kind of lingers, then if it still feels a bit troublesome, then maybe that whole scenario just needs a bit more meta around it, a bit more meta. Yeah. So in the Buddha's day, confession was practiced quite formally in the Sangha. So it was practiced at night if there was a new moon or a full moon. And what would happen is that the people in any given locality would come together and they would sit together out in the moonlight. And what they would do is they would just go around. And they would speak. They would go around and they would confess and they would listen. They would confess and they would be heard. And that was it. Nobody tried to rescue anybody. Nobody tried to minimise anybody. You just hear it as it is. Yeah? So in my chapter, what we do, and this is quite common in order situations, after somebody has confessed, we might say something to sort of formally acknowledge that, sort of say, I hear your confession, or I hear and accept your confession, something like that. We have a wee routine. We go, like, we get together, have a cup of tea, we talk rubbish about haircuts for a few minutes, and then we decide between us that we're going to chant a mantra, what that mantra is, and we chant that mantra. And then we say any confessions. And if people have confessions, they go round and they make those confessions. And sometimes that might actually need a little bit of teasing out. So it might be that, you know, I'm confessing something about a speech precept. But actually underneath it, maybe the eighth precept about covetousness was there, which I didn't see. But somebody might see that and tease that out. And then I'll see that actually that was the root of it. Was the covetousness, and the actual manifestation of it, which was the harsh speech, is actually a secondary thing. So that's really helpful, yeah? So sometimes we need a little bit of help in teasing out and clarifying. And that just asks for trust, doesn't it? Yeah? It asks for kindness towards oneself and asks for trust within the community. So confession builds trust, yeah? Sometimes we go around and an individual doesn't have a confession, but they just want to rejoice in something. Yeah? So they want to rejoice in something that they've overcome in themselves, say. Yeah? Or that they just appreciated about themselves. I had an experience quite recently. It was a really, really strong experience of confession. And it was at Akashavana on the ordination retreat. And it was one of the things that was strong about it was that it was completely spontaneous. but it was also sustained over quite a long number of days. So we were about 3 days into this fortnight-long retreat, and the people who were leading the retreat said that from now on in the evening rituals, we would have a slot for confession every night. So somebody put a bowl, really lovely terracotta bowl, up at the top of the shrine. And that what that meant is if you have a confession, you can write it on a piece of paper and put it in the bowl. And at some point, all those confessions get burned. But then, sort of on that first night of starting up that opportunity to have a confession every night, somebody also said, well, you can make the confessions verbally as well if you want. So there and then, a few people, when the time was right, they got up and they actually, rather than put their confession solely in the pot on a piece of paper, they said it out loud. Maybe 3 or 4 people did it. And something kind of caught, like a kind of wave of momentum caught. And then for the rest of the retreat, like 10, 11 days or something, people came up and did all their confessions verbally. And it had an incredibly transformative effect on us as a community. And like I said, it was completely and utterly spontaneous. It was not engineered by the retreat leaders, yeah? But people, I don't know, there was just something live between us. And we were all a little bit astonished by it, I think, you know? And God, there was one night, about halfway through, where somebody stood up and she said her confession out loud. And that was all fine. And then the next night she stood up and she said, oh, well, actually my confession is about the confession that I'd made the night before. And it just so happened, I mean, there was nothing particularly that struck me about it, but I did remember what it was. And what she said is, well, when I made that confession last night, actually, it was still bothering me. And so I think there was just like a bit of, I think I was feeling self-reproach, but it came out like an expression of self-hatred. So I want to confess that. You know, that was just amazing. It was like she could see that in her practice of confession, there was something that slightly turned it back on herself and pushed the thorn in. And so that she confessed, you know. So it was just incredibly strong. And it meant that as a community, it helped really, really build up this incredible harmony between us. Now, a lot of us didn't know each other before then. We came together in that context for that 2-week retreat. And we're living together, and we bonded with this incredible harmony and trust. And I think it was that amazing experience of confession, really, really, that held us in that ritual space. And I guess that possibly relates to what I'm going to say next, which is to do with context. So for us, there is a specific context for confession, and it relates to going for refuge, which is the kind of heart theme of an ordination retreat. So in the Sevenfold Puja, we go, there's this kind of movement, so you sort of see the Bodhisattva way of life, and it has a strong effect on you. You see it, and you honour it, and you commit yourself to that path. And then, having committed, that commitment takes the form of, is expressed in the form of taking the 3 refuges as our inspiration and guide, and taking the 5 or the 10 precepts as our training, yeah? So we're kind of emboldened and inspired. And that means that we actually just want to acknowledge that we've got this stuff, that we're a bit shabby and a bit cracked, and we've got these corners, and we want to give up whatever is in our mind stream that might hold us back from this path that we've just committed ourselves to. So it's kind of slightly back to front, because you commit yourself and then you kind of go, what are the obstacles? But I think that's great, because that just sort of shows that there was passion there, you know? There was passion. So we've got this bodhicitta as our common goal for all humanity. And so therefore it's important to just turn and examine what might hold us back, yeah? What might hold us back? So it's quite courageous, but it's kind of softened or emboldened maybe by metta, yeah? So what we're held back by, what we might be held back by, what we're attached to, and we just acknowledge that, yeah? Just acknowledging that. And that's confession, yeah? So it's in this context that we confess, and we confess in the presence of all the Buddhas. So I'm going to read you a snippet from the Bodhicaryavatara that just goes over that progression. Here and now I go for refuge to the Buddhas who protect the universe. Wholeheartedly, I go for refuge to the Dharma they have realized, which destroys the fears of cyclic existence, and to the community of Bodhisattvas. I offer myself to Samantabhadra. I give myself to Manjugosha. I cry out to the compassionate Avalokiteshvara, asking him to protect me. I bow down to Vajrapani. At the sight of him, the messengers of death scatter in all directions. I have ignored your advice, O great guides, but now, seeing my danger, I go for refuge and ask for your protection. Someone afraid of an ordinary illness will take their doctor's advice, but I have ignored the advice of the all-knowing doctor about the worst of diseases. Is there no end to my stupidity? If I am careful on an ordinary cliff, how much care should I take on the top of a precipice that drops for huge distances through great tracts of time? Yet, I take my pleasure thinking death won't come today, while my end gets nearer and nearer. Who has made me immune to death? Do I think I will escape it when nobody else can? How should I take my ease? Instead, I should keep in mind that unskillfulness always leads to suffering and that I need to liberate myself from the effects of my karma. Standing with folded hands before the guides of the world, fearful of the suffering I have stored up for myself, I confess all the unskillfulness I have piled up in my delusion. Prostrating again and again, I ask the leaders to accept my confession. What is not good, O protectors, I must not do again. So you can see in that how there's a progression that confession leads on from the taking of the refuges and precepts. And the Buddhas are very vividly present in those refuge verses, and so the Buddhas are in the Bodhicaryavatara present as you confess. There's a really lovely thing that Smriti Ratna said about the Bodhisattva, and Sadhana referred to it last night as well. I just wrote it down as he said it. He said the Bodhisattva, this is with regard to ethics, a Bodhisattva stays courageous, open-hearted and wise. I think that's great. A Bodhisattva stays courageous, open-hearted and wise. So I think that's what those verses are drawing us towards, yeah? And in the connection between going for refuge and confession, Bhante has talked about going for refuge as being the lifeblood of the spiritual life. And he's talked about the precepts as being the circulation of the blood. So it keeps our practice alive. Confession is the maintenance of our aliveness. It's our vitality, our spiritual vitality. So traditionally, confession has got four aspects that I just wanted to mention, and the Tibetan tradition calls these the four powers of confession. So first of all, there's like a recognition that you have a regret. Recognition of misdeeds with positive sadness is how Pema Chodron talks about it. So actually feeling remorse, yeah? Secondly, reliance on wisdom. So this is confessing in the presence of the Buddhas, reliance on the Buddhas for support. And that means that you're not alone. Yeah. Thirdly, remedial action. Fourthly, a resolve to do our best not to keep doing the same action. So the first of them, recognition of misdeeds with sadness. Yeah. So that's about remorse. And Subhuti wrote this booklet about confession in chapters, and he said this really good thing about remorse. He said that feeling remorse is like a really, really good thing if you feel remorse. And then not feeling remorse because you have an absence of remorse because you haven't done anything unskillful is also a really, really good thing. So it's like, it's great if you don't have remorse, but it's great if you do have remorse because you're on track. And so remorse here, regret, is the positive counterpart. It's like the healthy counterpart to guilt. Yeah. So remorse is just like, oh, got it wrong. Have an aspiration to live well, but that was a mistake. Yeah. So there's something in remorse that just sees conditionality at play. It doesn't feed into the story about how you're bad through and through. It's just quite clean. And it can be sore, yeah? It can be sore. And it relates back to the Buddha Amitabha, yeah? So that sense, a positive sense of feeling sorry that you have let yourself down is called Hiri, which is related to Hri, as in Om Amideva Hri. And this Hri literally means blushing, yeah? So it's quite tender. You're quite, with that regret, you're quite tender with yourself. But you're actually acknowledging that what you're on to actually is a confession. Yeah, so it's more than just an acknowledgement. The second power is this reliance on wisdom or reliance on the Buddhas, yeah? So you just remember that at this point, you are in training. So it's not the end of the world. It's okay. You can have courage, yeah? So Vajrasattva loves you deeply from his heart of hearts, yeah? And the Buddhas just think you're doing great, actually. And they can see you're in training, so you can have courage, yeah? The third power is just putting it right, yeah? Now, this might not always be appropriate, but it's just like, again, it's something that we reflect on. Is there a place for an apology, yeah? Can you counter a negative action with a positive action? Is there an opportunity there for you to do that? That might not always be appropriate, but if it is, take it, yeah? And I guess the thing is to just do the reflection and ask the question. And then lastly, making a resolve not to do it again, yeah, to the best of your ability. So that is the kind of, that kind of stamps it as the kind of hallmark of a confession, if that's not too weighty a language. Knowing that actually you don't want to go there again, yeah, and then you can put it down. So, yeah, reliance on the Buddhas, purifying the mind, yeah. So I just want to finish by looking at the way that we talk about purifying the mental poisons, yeah. So the mental poisons are connected to the wisdoms of the five Buddhas, and we're going to look at this over our weekend retreat here together at the end of the week. So I just want to evoke a reminder of those five poisons and the wisdoms into which they are transmuted. So we enter the mandala, yeah, and we come into the realm of Buddha Akshobhya. And what Buddha Akshobhya reflects to us is that there are traces of ill will, hatred, yeah? The poison of hatred, ill will, aversion, mental aversion, physical violence, the basic desire to say no and push away, yeah? So this fighting, the fighting in us, physically and mentally, is transformed through clarity. And the clarity transforms into the mirror-like wisdom of Akshobhya. And this wisdom is clarity in its very purest form. There is no distortion, yeah? So things are clearly seen just as they are with the power of that clarity. And that clarity cuts through our biases and renders reality into its innate purity. Things appear to us clear and unsullied. It's quite a beautiful state. And then there is the poison of pride. And maybe pride holds us back from confession. Yeah, maybe we don't want to come into relationship with our messiness. Maybe we don't want to speak our confession aloud. Pride is transmuted by letting go and giving, just giving of ourselves. Yeah, letting go of our holding back and just making ourselves available to others. Noticing how much we hold in common with others. Yeah, so this eventually leads us into the wisdom of equality, where we see all beings as our own being. This is the wisdom of Ratnasambhava. All natures are ultimately our own Buddha nature. Yeah? And we recognize our face in the face of every living being. And the quality of that recognition is also beauty. And then there's craving. So it's a kind of needy, grasping, wanting, neurotic longing for what actually can't satisfy. And that object taunts us, it kind of goads us, and it makes us kind of ill-fitting in our own skin. It makes our mouth kind of dry with thirst. And that thirst, that longing, is purified by a fire of unconditional love. It's deep love. It's kind of pure metta. And it nourishes. And it can only come, that deep fire, it can actually only come from within. We have to turn within to meet Amitabha, to meet his light. And that light helps us see that which is within us is love itself. And that love brings this discriminating wisdom. So it sees and it celebrates the uniqueness of every individual condition, every moment, every mind moment. So in the world of Amitabha, everything is unique and complete in itself. And then there's jealousy. So it's kind of twisting. Jealousy is a kind of twisting, contorting, comparison-making jealousy, and it tells us that somehow we are not where it's at. Yeah, where it's at is somewhere else. But Amoghasiddhi cuts into that with this big energy. So he's fearless. He fearlessly embraces you just as you are. He fearlessly places you on the axis of a great double vajra at the heart of the universe. So in Amoghasiddhi's world, you are the center of the universe because he places you there, yeah? And that gives you the wisdom that spontaneously accomplishes all skillful action, yeah? Because we do not fear, yeah? So we've broken down the poor me with his fearless heart, yeah? And breaking down that poor me, we are transformed into the spiritual warrior. So all of these four poisons, they're just like a mix. They're the mix that mix up and make ignorance. Yeah, and maintained by lack of awareness, ignorance rolls on and on. And that awareness, so awareness itself transforms the ignorance into the wisdom of the Dharma Dhatu. I can't say anything about that because it's beyond words and it's beyond description. And I think it's probably beyond praise. Yeah. So as we move towards confession, we purify these poisons. We're not necessarily looking out for them. We're just trying to stay with that sensibility to what's next. What's the next small act? Yeah, it's not the big battlefield. It's the next small, kindly act. And that's what purifies these poisons. And we start to develop these wisdoms just by developing simple awareness, yeah? It keeps that lifeblood of going for refuge circulating, yeah? So that we can have access to that aliveness, that honesty in the heart. So that's the path. Good luck. Wish me luck.